Thank you. Okay. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Great. Well, tonight we're going to do something a little different. In the past studies, we've focused on people, but mainly on issues that they were facing and how they faced them. And the issues were theology, culture, things that were impacting the church. Tonight it's going to really be more about a man, and how he faced the life that God gave him. And that person is Eric Little, which I had mentioned last week. And I want you to think about something. It's not about the issues, though those were raging even in his time. So remember last week, the issues we talked about with modernism and liberalism and all these isms that were affecting the church in Machen's time. Well, Eric Little was living in that time. But it's kind of, his story is sort of like, to use a military analogy, it's going to be about how you live your life when you aren't called to participate in the high-level war negotiations, but you're just given orders to go and do what you're supposed to do in the face of deadly enemy fire. So you're not in the spotlight. You're just doing what you're told to do. Or to use a sports analogy, it's how you live your life when you aren't involved in the pregame activities that showcase the superstars of the team, but you're just told to give everything you've got against a very strong opponent in order for the team to have a chance of winning. But even more than that, it's about how you live your life when you once were at the center of the worldly stage, even at the center of the center of the worldly stage, and have moved almost as far away from the spotlight is as physically possible in this world. So that's the life we're going to look at tonight. Now, there are going to be quotes, but not like last week. They're not quotes about theology. They're reminiscences from people that knew Eric Little. All right. So how we live our lives, wherever God has placed us, shows us and the world who we really are. It's easier to be dramatically humble for a short time on a brightly lit national stage with full TV coverage than it is to be faithfully obedient in a dirty, out-of-the-way corner of nowhere with God as the audience. God reveals who we really are by placing us individually in our own specially designed, unique situations where our true nature is forced to the surface and is displayed for the angels and the powers and the principalities in the heavenly realms to witness. So thus far in our studies, we've looked at men and women whose faith was revealed in the furnace of persecution. This time we'll look at a man whose faith is revealed in the cauldron of affliction, which is a slightly different lesson, but one we should learn as well, since we may not suffer direct persecution, but we may be caught in the repercussions and consequences of a culture that's drunk on freedoms, but that may forcibly and violently move to restrict the freedoms of Christians and put us in that dark corner of nowhere. So, don't mean to be a downer. Everybody's just staring at me, but I am trying to set the stage. This is somebody that we can really learn from. As usual, I want to give you the resources I use in the study and remind you this is just an introduction. to Eric Little. Number one, the video from Day of Discovery, the story of Eric Little, an Olympic gold medalist, lifelong race to spread the gospel. This is from 2004. It's a three-part series that is detailed enough to provide an understanding of the outline of his life, but which also provides the spiritual context of it, of his works. It contains interviews with his daughters and many that knew him in China. I rate this as one of my all-time favorite documentaries. Please watch it if you ever get a chance. Second is Eric Little, Pure Gold, by David McCaslin, came out in 2001. This is the book that video is based on. The author is a Christian and is the moderator of the video. I highly recommend this book since it has more detail than the movie. Next, The Final Race by Eric T. Eichinger from 2018. The author is a Lutheran minister who ran track in college and served as a missionary in China for a time, just like Eric Little. This has some details that the earlier work by McCaslin does not have and has a good take on the spiritual aspects in Little's life. I recommend this book as well. And then finally, For the Glory, written by Duncan Hamilton in 2016. This is a look at Little's life from the pen of a renowned sports writer. It's got more details, but less of a spiritual focus. I haven't finished reading it, so I can't give a recommendation, but I have pulled some from it. Now, as we approach Eric Little's life, let's remember that some of us are more prone than others to the temptations of vanity and the desire to be loved and admired by others. We secretly believe that we are really worth the attention because of who we are. And if we aren't in a position that gives us that attention, well, then we become irritable and restless until we can maneuver or manipulate things to the point where we are getting the notice we think we deserve. Another way of saying it is that we are all tempted to think more highly of ourselves, of our name, of our reputation, than we should. And as a consequence, we think less of our fellow brothers and sisters that we come in contact with. On the other hand, let us also remember that some people may seem to be immune to this temptation because of their personality. But even shy and timid people struggle with the same temptations that vocal and demonstrative people do. They just do it internally with fewer outward witnesses. But we must remember that the Lord looks on the heart and that this temptation to pride and self-importance that speaks either loudly or softly to that part deep inside all of us is as deadly to the shy person as it is to the bold. But wait a minute, haven't we all been told that we need a good self-image in order to have good self-esteem? Well, yes, by the world we've been told that, but this attitude about my self-importance is vitally connected to the root sin of pride that caused our first parents to fall. They had been instructed and warned and admonished, and though they both complained that they had been coerced, Eve by the serpent and Adam by Eve, they both acted on their own volition and willingly disobeyed God because they believed, if only for that brief moment, that they knew what was best for their lives and they deserved the best and that God was unfairly holding it back from them. Now, I say all this because while I believe Eric Little was a shy man by nature, I also believe he was one of the most humble men I have ever read about. Now we need to understand that humility isn't just the opposite of boldness. Otherwise, all shy and timid people would be humble, and we know that isn't true. The primary way that humility differs from shyness or timidity is the way a humble person thinks about themselves and about other people, and the fact that they think of other people at all. Now here you may be thinking, well, now you are just saying I need to become a people person. Isn't that just another personality trait though? No. A people person engages people because it's what pleases and energizes them. They can be very outgoing and interested in people's lives without really caring about them enough to help them or serve them. And that is the primary difference and the defining quality of humility. It sees others as worthy of serving for the Lord's sake. Jesus said, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and your neighbor as yourself. The Christian character trait that makes this possible and which we must work to put on is humility, as Paul tells us in Colossians 3. Eric Little put on humility towards others and love to the Lord in such tremendously practical ways throughout his life that he is worthy of our admiration as he followed Christ in his special circumstances. Now, for those that are not familiar with him, I will briefly tell the story of his life and include examples of his unfailing willingness to love God and to serve others. He was born in 1902 in Tientsin, China, to missionary parents. But at the age of 7, during a furlough to his parents' home in Scotland, he and his older brother, Rob, were enrolled in the school for the Sons of Missionaries. And his parents and his younger sister went back to China. He only saw them twice in 11 years, and soon after they returned in 1920, he entered the University of Edinburgh at the age of 18. At college, he became a national sensation on the rugby team, along with his brother. He taught Sunday school at Morningside Congregational Church and also became very interested in science and how it complemented rather than conflicted with his faith. He graduated in 1923 with a Bachelor of Science in Chemistry. And it was during his university days that he became not just nationally, but internationally known for his speed in the 100-yard and the 220-yard races and for his unconventional style of running. Another runner who went on to represent Britain in multiple Olympics said about his first time seeing Eric Little run, quote, off to a slow start, he ran with blazing speed, chin up, head back on his shoulders, and his arms thrashing the air. Dreadful style, said the cynical critics, but his space-devouring legs raced on a straight path to the tape, and to me he typified the speed runner putting all his strength in this effort to gain victory. End quote. So he's very unconventional, but he didn't care. He was doing what God had given him the strength to do in the way that God had taught him. He was the most famous athlete in the whole of Great Britain and was adored by everyone. His fame was so great that all of Britain was certain that he had virtually already won the gold medal in the 1924 Summer Olympics to be held in France the next year. All of this part of his life is told with some accuracy in the Academy Award-winning 1981 movie, Chariots of Fire. The crucial issue that the movie is built around is that though Eric was favored to win the 100-meter race and be known as the fastest man in the world. The heats for the 100 and the two relays he was to compete in were going to be held on Sunday. The movie shows Eric only finding out about this on the way to Paris for the games and struggling with whether or not to run. But in reality, he knew about the schedule in the fall of 1923 and had made his decision known immediately to the Olympic Committee that he would not run. Now, in a complete turnaround from the type of press he'd been receiving during his university days, and even during the time he was a Christian speaker, speaking to thousands about his faith, he was now roundly condemned and even called a traitor to his country. As I mentioned, he was a very shy person and he didn't like the fame and attention. So this really didn't bother him because he didn't pay any attention to it. He was asked by a reporter if he could just adjust the timing of the Sabbath or dedicate his running to the Lord for part of the Sabbath and therefore still compete. And his answer was, "My Sabbath lasts all day." So lost in all of this was the fact that he was still planning on competing in the 200 meter race, which was on Tuesday and Wednesday. And then there was the possibility of competing in the 400 meter race. But the problem was that he had never competed at that distance of 400 meters. As the pressure mounted, everyone felt sure he would lose the 400. As he remained firm in his decision not to run the 100, at least one paper admired him for it. They said, quote, 99 men gifted with Eric's prowess would now be insufferably swollen-headed. But here we have the 100th man. Here is a man who hates praise and shuns publicity, yet is deserving of both. Here is a man with a mind of his own and not afraid to voice his most sacred feeling on a platform if, by doing so, he thinks it will help his fellows. Here is a man who has courage and delights to accept a challenge, be it for the sake of his school, his country, or his God. And lastly, here is a man who wins because he sets his teeth quietly but firmly and always plays the game. Well, he went and he won the bronze medal in the 200, which disappointed everyone, even though he medaled. And then, unbelievably, he won the 400 meters with a new world record, something he had never even competed in. His critics once again became his friends. One reporter said to him while interviewing him, "Mr. Little, one paper, the Scotsman, said that you achieved immortality in Paris." Eric replied, "No, sir, my immortality comes from Christ, not a track and field stadium in France." What a humble, true to his God sort of person. So the events of the 1924 Olympics and the vindication of his decision not to compete on Sunday closed the movie Chariots of Fire with the familiar theme song. But Eric Little's life of service to God was ready for the next step. Seminary training, with the goal of entering the mission field in China where his parents and his sister still were. During his seminary studies, he grappled with that same modernist liberal movement and was familiar with that sermon that I quoted last week that was preached by the Baptist in the Presbyterian pulpit. But in his direct but simple approach, he reasoned that the literal interpretation of Scripture, rather than the non-inspired, fallible view of the liberals, was correct, and he didn't worry about it anymore. He continued his speaking engagements and began preparing for his return to China as a chemistry teacher in the Tsitsin Anglo-Chinese College, headed by a noted physicist, Dr. Samuel Lavington Hart, who also believed in sharing Christ in an academic and even scientific setting. In July of 1925, a year after the Olympics, Eric returned to China, the place of his birth, and began his work at the college, which was at the same mission with his parents. Now, as you can imagine, he gave of himself to the college and the students, many of whom were Chinese, in the same way he approached any endeavor. He was fully committed to it. He taught science in the morning and led the college's morning worship services. In the afternoon, he developed an athletic program with races, games, and full-fledged track and field meets with his students. At the church, he was the superintendent of the Sunday school, taught a class for boys, facilitated Bible studies in some of the Chinese congregations, and volunteered as a chaplain to the British troops that rotated through the city, all with the background of guns, as fighting between warring Chinese factions went on outside the compound. In spite of his full schedule, though, he had managed to fix his affections on one of the daughters of another missionary family, Florence McKenzie, who was several years younger than he was. A long period of engagement followed as she returned to her native Canada to obtain her nursing degree. They were finally married in March of 1934, and during the intervening years, Eric had taken on additional duties at the college. In addition to his other duties, he was now secretary of the college, and having recently been ordained, he was now part of the preaching rotation at Union Church. He would continue to display his willingness to serve in countless ways, not only in the work of the mission, but in everyday life. His family also began to grow. First, Patricia was born in 1935, and then Heather in 1937. At this point, the London Missionary Society requested that Eric leave Tientsin and to take over the mission at Shaoxing, since he had experience and was now an ordained minister. He wrestled with the opportunity and finally decided that he would follow the calling to Shaoxing, but leave Florence and the girls in Tientsin. The wisdom of his decision was reinforced when Japan attacked China later that year. This meant that the outlying villages where he was going were raided routinely and missionaries were without the protection that the central compound provided in Tientsin. In Shaoxing, Eric carried the strange title of hospital superintendent, which meant he could ride a bicycle around to all the villages, even in the midst of the warring factions swarming in the area. He became recognized by both sides as someone who could help if there were medical needs. More than one of his biographers has said that Eric exuded a love for humanity that transcended cultures. He was as kind to perceived enemies as he was to locals. He had the ability to diffuse a tense situation with humor and a smile, even while being interviewed and interrogated at gunpoint. It didn't matter what work needed to be done. He did it with great cheer. And as he progressed, he sensed that he had made the right decision moving from the classroom as a teacher to the countryside as a pastor. As the war heightened, he sang and whistled and hummed through the trials because of his strong sense of the nearness of God. I'm going to read an example of his work. As soon as I can find it. Hold on. All right, here you go. he wrote this in a letter so that people would understand. But this is not the exact wording of the letter. It says, months earlier, while transporting an ill Chinese man to the hospital in Shaoxing via a mule cart that he was driving, Eric heard of another man in nearby Pangshuang who was barely clinging to life. Although by any standards, it was a dangerous mission to try to rescue the second man, Eric felt compelled to try nonetheless. Eric found the man with a deep gash in his neck. He and five others had been taken out by the Japanese and then forced to kneel in the dirt. Using a saber, a Japanese officer beheaded each victim. But the sixth man, the man that Eric was rescuing, had somehow survived for several days lying in a temple. Eric found the man and managed to get him into the cart with his other wounded passenger. Painstakingly, he carried the two over a nearly 20-mile journey of bumpy roads and fields to the hospital in Shaoxing. The first man died, but when the second man recovered, he became a Christian and soon thereafter painted a peony rose picture with a Chinese caption that read, quote, "The peony rose is the most beautiful in China. Her modesty and manner come from God." He gave the painting to Eric. Eric had the painting copied and brought several with him to England. So his was not a typical pastorate. His was a mercy missionary as well. Now I'm going to read a quote that he wrote to his wife and the girls along this same time. He said, "Often now when I'm cycling from village to village, what with the frozen ground and the ruts, I have great difficulty in staying on the bicycle, and I have a splendid collection of bruises. Nearly everyone is afraid to speak to me in public, but going into their homes, telling them how so many others are in a similar situation, and getting them to sing hymns has a wonderfully restorative effect. Especially when I sing in English, which makes everyone roar with laughter, even though they don't have much to be cheerful about. Now, with so many homes vandalized by visiting troops, most people are living crowded together, hungry and prey to disease. At least since the national government outlawed foot binding, the women and girls are spared the agonizing pain and deformity. But in places where Jesus is scarcely known, you find next to nothing is done to help the weak and distressed, especially children and more especially girls. Do you remember that little girl, frostbitten as the result of neglect, whose feet had to be taken off? Though with care, did grow well and strong. Well, I found out quite recently that she married and that her children taught how love can help and heal. We must never forget that Jesus means us to pass on to others his love in deeds of kind thought. Remember that what is done for one of his little ones is done for him. But goodness knows where it will all end. What with the Japanese, local warlords, and increasingly poor living conditions, the situation here is growing worse each day. I wonder what has gone wrong with the world." Well, that was the summer, well, that was the end of 1938. As you can imagine, things were going to get worse. In the summer of 1939, Eric and his family went to Canada for a furlough. Days after arriving, World War II was underway. As the year progressed, he was due to be in Britain, but once again decided it was best for his family not to accompany him across the very dangerous submarine-infested waters of the Atlantic, but to go alone. Several months later, with the waters determined to be safer, his family followed in an uneventful voyage. Then in 1940, as the war was heating up further, they were all ordered back to China. They had to cross the Atlantic once again, but this time things were different. I will quote an example of his very strong faith in God's protection and of his very bad judgment as he writes this to his mother about the crossing. This is to his mother, remember. We went on board at the scheduled time. There was a good bit of inspection. Cameras were taken from us and will be returned on landing. The boat has a number of children on board. I don't know how many, but I should say at least half are children. It's a small boat with a complement of 300 passengers or crew and crew. There are a few even younger than Heather. We were in a convoy and had an escort. The convoy is a delightful sight. Can you imagine 50 ships all going along together? Not, of course, in single file, but in about five lines. It is magnificent. Most of the ships are cargo ones. Any passenger ships are in the center for greater protection. It wasn't until we were off the Irish coast that the real excitement started. It was 8:30 at night when the children were asleep and we were hit by a torpedo. Whether it was a dud and only the cap exploded, or whether it had expended its energy having been fired from too great a distance, or it exploded right below us, we are not sure. I would say that we were actually hit and that only the cap exploded, judging from the feel in our cabin. No alarm was given for us to go to the boats, but the signal for all boats to zigzag was given by ours. The next night, we lost one of our ships at the back of the convoy. The sea was choppy, a very difficult one to spot submarines in. The escort left us the next day. This was the hardest of all days. About 10 a.m., a small boat about a quarter of a mile from us was torpedoed, blew up, and sank in 2 minutes. They must have hit the engine boiler. We were on deck ready for boats, and everyone zigzagged. About noon, the all clear went, and we returned to dinner. We had just started and were halfway through the first course when the alarm went again. Another boat torpedoed. It didn't sink. We heard later that it was able to get along. Whether it turned back or tried to carry on, I don't know. Again, his faith, his consistent faith, he kept his wife and his children very calm during all this, but I cannot believe he wrote that to his mother. I cannot imagine her receiving that, thinking about her husband, I mean her son and her grandchildren. Anyway, they finally arrived in China in October of 1940, and they found the situation worse than before, causing Eric to once again leave them in Tientsin while he went to Shaojiang. He resumed his work of bicycling to the villages. He described his work to Florence in a short note, giving all the time and trying to get to know the people and trying to leave them a message of encouragement and peace in a time when there is no external peace at all. One of the other missionaries there described the mission like this. Our peaceful state is, some of us think, due to an early attitude that Eric Little helped us to. One of treating all these soldiers as children of God whom he cares for, and that it was for us, as we showed these over the premises, to witness to them, explain why we were here, and try to help them as we ourselves have been helped by the Almighty. To this end, Eric spent most of one day with the Japanese in our city, and I think those who listened certainly caught some of his idea. For the next time they came, they were full of questions, and one Japanese spent an hour with me in my room in the hospital. It is possible that there was room for doubt as to the genuine spirit of this Japanese response, but there can be none as to the eager sincerity of Eric Little's desire for them. And one more. Eric would just shoot off on a bicycle and go anywhere and everywhere all over the countryside. He was an evangelist to the villages. He didn't stay put. He was out most of the time. Very rarely was he staying with us in our houses. And he kept his wife and his babies in Chichen, where they were safer because it really was dangerous here. We were constantly being shot at or locked up by the communists for identification. He was an extraordinarily fearless person. He had this awareness of Jesus being with him all the time. If you ever ask him a question of should we do this or that, he would lower his head and say, quote, yes, well, just be quiet for a little while. Then he would raise his head, come out smiling. He gave me a new discipline because I had someone to check things with. What a man. Now, in the spring of 1941, Eric and Florence knew the situation was worsening and that she and the children had to leave and return to Canada. And by then, they were expecting a third child. Eric felt called to stay, but said he would remain another year or two at most, then return to them. They returned to Canada with an uneventful voyage, and he returned to Tietzen. By mid-September, he received news that they had a third daughter, Maureen. Then in January of 1942, all the remaining British and American nationals were ordered to pack up for relocation. So from the time Florence had left until they finally relocated, Eric lived with another family, the Reverend and Mrs. Smith. And when he found that it was difficult for Mrs. Smith to get enough food for them, Eric volunteered to get up to be at the bakery at 5 o'clock in the morning before the lines formed. Also at that time, there was a very bad dust storm. And even with the windows closed, dust covered everything in their home. Mrs. Smith was overwhelmed with the enormity of the cleanup task. But the next morning when she came downstairs, she found that Eric had gotten up at 4:30 and completed the cleaning without making a sound. I'm going to read a quote from the Reverend Mr. Smith. For a year, we had the privilege of Eric sharing our home. I never saw him angry. I never heard him say a cross or unkind word. He just went about doing good. And he did so unobtrusively, so self-effacingly, and so naturally that one just took it for granted that Eric was just like that. Because day by day, he kept an early morning meeting with his Lord. The pattern of his daily living was so little marred by faults because he offered up quite simply each smallest thing to Christ. He was Christ's man. Now in 1943, after a year in this situation, Eric and the other missionaries were transferred 400 miles away to the Weishin camp in Shantung province, which had at one time been an American Presbyterian mission, but was now a prisoner of war camp. Eric and the few missionaries from Tietzin, along with 1,800 others, including some missionaries from other locations, but mostly professional people, bankers, accountants, engineers, etc., lived in the mission, which was walled off by an electric fence, watchtowers, and patrolled by guards with police dogs. They woke every day to roll call, drills, hunger, and backed up latrines. There were only 4 showers and very little water. 2 weeks after arriving, in this place, he wrote to Florence in Canada, quote, simple, hardy life under primitive conditions, living with Josh and Bear in small room, good fellowship, good games, teaching in school, food sufficient, boundless love. It was so short because this was a Red Cross telegram that was limited to 25 words. But in those 25 words, you hear his optimism, his faith, his love, his care for other people coming through. With staggering heat in the summer and freezing cold in the winters, the attitude in the camp quickly deteriorated as everyone realized the reality of their situation. Tempers flared, and selfishness was the dominant sin in the camp, but not for Eric. He established a Sunday school and an athletic program. I'm going to read another quote from one of the other internees there, who was a young lady at the time. Her name was Mary Taylor Previte, the great-granddaughter of Hudson Taylor, who founded the China Inland Mission. And she had only been 9 when the Japanese rounded up her siblings, her teachers, and herself from their boarding school in Chifu. In her writings about her time in Wuxian, she fondly remembers Uncle Eric saying, quote, almost everyone in camp had heard of Eric Little. The folklore about him seemed almost bigger than life. But Uncle Eric wasn't a big deal type. He never sought the spotlight. Instead, he made his niche by doing little things other people hardly noticed. You had to do a lot of imagining to think that Eric Little had grabbed world headlines almost 20 years earlier, an international star in track and rugby. When we had a hockey stick that needed mending, Uncle Eric would truss it up almost as good as new with strips ripped from his sheets. When the teenagers got bored with the deadening monotony of prison life and turned for relief to the temptations of clandestine sex, he and some missionary teachers organized an evening game room. When the Tietzen boys and girls were struggling with their homework, Uncle Eric coached them in science, and when kitchen number 1 competed in races in the inner kitchen rivalry, well, who could lose with Eric Little on our team? End quote. Now, she said that he helped them with their schoolwork. What she didn't say was what others say in the video, and that is because there were no textbooks, he wrote a chemistry book for them. I mean, I just can't imagine that. From memory, he wrote a chemistry book. And in the video, one of the young women at that time, who is now an older woman, showed the chemistry book. He had diagrams. He had equations. He had ways of carrying on experiments. He had all of that. Okay, I'm going to quote from a former student. Sorry, I keep jumping around, but these are such dear quotes. This was one of his students. I met Eric for the first time in Wuxian internment camp in 1943 when I was 18 years of age. At a special evangelism rally, he spoke on the story of the rich young ruler, showing us in a way I shall never forget the cost of Christian discipleship. I was immediately impressed by his humility and directness of speech. This was apparent not only at a religious meeting, but also as a coach or a referee on the playing field or in the lecture hall. Together with other young people, I had the great privilege of listening to Eric as a private tutor, lecturer on physics and chemistry. As I recall his painstaking teaching methods and his patience with me, who was always slow to grasp mathematical formula, I am amazed and grateful for this example of a superb teacher. Now, what he didn't say, but what it goes on to say here is how thrilled many of Eric's pupils felt when years after detainment ended, the schooling they received in the camp was deemed acceptable at top universities. What a commitment from Eric to teach at that level in the middle of horrific conditions. Now, there are many, many other quotes, some direct from people who knew him at that time. And I really encourage you to watch that video. It is very, very touching. Now, at one point, Eric received a letter from Florence, his wife, and she said, "Oh, Eric, my thoughts and prayers are ever with you, and I long for the time when we'll be able to live as a family again. But as I said before, I'm sure we have both learned a great deal and had a lot of experiences that we would not have missed for anything. We will appreciate our life together all the more, and in the meantime, we have some wonderful memories to live on. Yours forever in a day, Florence." Now, at the time, he was cheerfully giving away his rations to others. He was joyfully standing in line for other people to receive their rations. He was happily giving them his blankets, giving to anyone in any way he could. Most of those who remember him said he was unfailingly cheerful and eager to help them with everything they needed. And in January of 1945, he and many others came down with flu and sinusitis. Eric didn't improve and finally checked into the hospital. His speech had slowed, as had his walk. The camp noticed that Uncle Eric was not there to brighten things up. In early February, he suffered a mild stroke but continued to fight back to health. But by February 18th, the doctors diagnosed he was dying of a brain tumor. On February 21st, he wrote a letter to Florence and walked to the post office to mail it. He returned to the hospital and at 3:30 that very afternoon breathed his last words to his nurse and longtime friend. Quote, "Annie, it's complete surrender to God." His life and work was complete. He had run his race so as to finish well, and he did. He never saw his wife and daughters again, and never saw his youngest daughter ever. They were all devastated and lived the rest of their lives missing him. When the movie Chariots of Fire came out, his daughters were pleased, but said it meant nothing if only they could see their dad again. It wasn't until the Day of Discovery video that I've mentioned had been made that the daughters were able to see the many, many people whose lives their dad had touched in the prison camp, that they were finally able to see God's hand at work for good. There are those who have characterized Eric Little as a modern martyr, but that's not true. He was not killed, nor was he imprisoned for his faith. He was, in my estimation, one of the finest examples of a man living out his confidence in God in a very difficult situation, but one that he knew how to glorify God in, simple obedience and simple service. Paul says in Philippians 2, "Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men, And being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Now, I'm going to end with a prayer from the only booklet that he ever wrote, simply titled Discipleship. Father, I pray that no circumstances, however bitter or however long drawn out, may cause me to break thy law, the law of love to thee and to my neighbor, that I may not become resentful, have hurt feelings, hate, or become embittered by life's experiences, but that in and through all I may see thy guiding hand and have a heart full of gratitude for thy daily mercy, daily love, daily power, and daily presence. Help me in the day when I need it most to remember that all things work together for good to them that love the Lord, that I can do all things through him that strengthens me, that my grace is sufficient for thee, my strength is made perfect in weakness. Now unto him who is able to keep you from falling and to present you faultless before the presence of his glory with exceeding joy, to the only wise God our Savior, be glory and majesty, dominion and power, both now and forever. Amen. Okay, Jerry, I'm done with the lesson.